One evening last month, I came home, sort of plopped down at the kitchen table, and looked at the day's mail. So as I was going through the mail, there was the usual stuff that was there. There were magazines and ads and bills and personal letters. And then I saw it, a letter unlike all of the others, distinguished by its lack of stamp, because apparently the U.S. Postal Service has a special deal with the Internal Revenue Service, and they don't require stamps. So reluctantly, I opened my form letter from the IRS declaring that Charlene and I were being audited. Although only on one area of our federal income tax return, and that was giving. Now, I don't know if you get these feelings, but the feeling that I got was roughly the equivalent to the feeling that I get when I hear a siren, look in the rearview mirror, and see the flashing lights, and my stomach just twists into a knot. And I look at the speedometer, and I'm going 47 and a 55, but I still feel terribly guilty and fearful, and I imagine all of the awful consequences that are going to come from whatever all of this is about. But as I thought about it, all things considered, I suppose that an IRS audit, which we are still in the process of, is not the worst thing that could possibly happen. Although it did make me wonder, what if God were to do some kind of an audit of us and our finances? It seems to me it would be kind of the other way around. The issue with the IRS, of course, is that they're auditing to make sure that we didn't give too much. I suppose with God, the audit would be to find out whether we gave enough or if we gave at all. And it raises the question that I think all serious Christian givers sooner or later ask, and that is, how much? After all, the IRS has a standard that they have entered into their computer, a formula of what they think is appropriate for people to contribute and whether or not they exceed that amount. Now, there are many Christians who have taken the old way as an approach, the old way being what the Old Testament says in the law, and they have set up as a standard a tithe. The word tithe, by the way, comes from a medieval term that means 10%, that they have concluded that they should donate 10% of their money or their possessions. So, for example, I want to read to you a number of quotes from the Old Testament, but mostly we're going to look in the New Testament, and you want to be ready for that in 2 Corinthians 7 and 8. And I'll remind you again, we're in 3 weeks of study on 2 Corinthians 7 and 8, and you can use your own Bible or page 1801 on the Blue Wooddale Bible, and there's a supply of them right back there that you can get at any time. But let's go to the Old Testament. Just listen. Leviticus 27:30 says, "A tithe of everything from the land, whether grain from the soil or fruit from the trees, belongs to the Lord. It is holy to the Lord." In fact, when those ancient Israelites didn't tithe, when they didn't pay their amount to the temple, it was considered a serious offense to the point that they were told that they were actually robbing God. So the prophet Malachi says in Malachi 3, 8 and 9, "Will a man rob God? Yet you rob me. But you ask, how do we rob you? In tithes and offerings. You are under a curse, the whole nation of you, because you are robbing me." Now, let me tell you that it actually is not a simple thing to figure out what they were doing in the Old Testament when it came to this business of tithing or of giving a certain amount to God and to the temple and to all that was happening among the people of God. So let me give you a quick overview, sort of a table of tithes. There is what is called the Lord's tithe in Leviticus 27:30, and it is 10% of someone's income. However, there is also a festival tithe that is described in Deuteronomy 12, and that's another 10%, and you can sort of run a total on this. You're up to 20%. in Deuteronomy 14, 28, and 29, there is what is called a poor tithe that was required of the Hebrew people, and it was 10% exacted once every 3 years, or roughly 3% per year. They also had, in Leviticus 19, verses 9 and 10, what they called the gleaning law. And that was that in this agricultural economy, you could not harvest your fields all the way to the perimeter. You had to leave 1 or 2% unharvested so that poor people could go and they could eat from your field. So you had another 2%. And then in Exodus 23:19, they had what was called a free will offering of first fruits. That was at their harvest or their Thanksgiving time. So throw in another 10%. And then periodically, there were special offerings like the one in Exodus chapter 25, verses 1 through 7, which was to raise money to build first the tabernacle and then the Old Testament temple in Jerusalem. Now, you start adding all those together, and you end up with a total of what they were expected to pay somewhere in the vicinity of 45% of their annual income. Now, it gets confusing because there was no distinction in Old Testament Israel between government and religion, or as we would say, church and state. So what they're talking about would be equivalent to what we might talk about as sales tax and of income tax and of contributions and all of it. But the point being that it added up to a significant percentage of their total income. Now, ironically, when all of this was started, it was started with the intention that this be a joyous thing. This is giving to God. This is part of the privilege of being an Israelite, being part of the nation of Israel, God's chosen people. However, what happened was it became terribly legalistic, where people were figuring exact percentages on their ancient equivalent to a computer, and it became burdensome, not a joyful, fun thing at all. And there are two observations that we can get from this. One was that tithing up to 45% was mandatory under Old Testament law. And number two, that tithing was never again taught in the New Testament. So it's an Old Testament concept. It's not a Christian concept in the New Testament. So actually, not much of this helps Christians get any idea at all of what is an appropriate amount for those who are generous to give as a blessing to others. So instead of the Old Testament, we as Christians turn to the New Testament, and especially to 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, which takes an extremely different approach to the whole idea of giving. In the New Testament, giving is not mandated. It's encouraged. Percentages and amounts, they're not set. There is no New Testament tithe. And the Christian gets to pick his or her own number. It's not chosen by the religion or the government or the Bible. Okay, so let's do it. Pick a number. You pick any number you want. Pick zero. Pick 100. Pick any percentage, any amount, anything. Just in your own mind, just pick any number you want. Now, there are many Christians who still pick a number of 10%. That's fine. Pick any number you like. God bless the 10%ers. That's just fine. Understand that you choose whatever number you want. It's totally up to you. Let me tell you what Americans give. Many Americans pick a much smaller number. Americans who earn less than $25,000 a year, on average, give $286 away in a course of a year. Those earning $25,000 to $50,000 give $1,340 a year away. However, when their salary doubles to $50,000 to $75,000, they give $40 more, which is $1,380 a year. $75,000 to $100,000 goes to $2,150. $100,000 to $200,000, those people donate $3,298 a year. $200,000 to $500,000 to a half million. Typically, that person gives $7,868 a year. If now we're getting close to your income, $500,000 to $1 million a year, that means you give $19,122. One to $1.5 million, $47,000. $1.5 million to $2 million, $105,000. Those of us in the category of $5 to $10 million a year give about $275,000 a year, and those in the room, which we're down to the last 10%, is $10 million or more in annual income, gives about $1.8 million per year. So you pick a number. You pick absolutely any number that you want to pick. You can pick 100% or 10% or zero or the average American, remembering, of course, that the average numbers for Americans in terms of contributions includes a significant number of people who do choose zero. And so that affects what the average is. The point here is to just pick any number you want to get started. And you pick a number that comes into your heart or your head or that you guess or imagine that you would like to give away to God and to others. So that's step number one. Hope you've got a number. All right, step number two is to adjust that number. So we can adjust the number up or we can adjust the number down. And the New Testament does give us guidelines on how to make the adjustments. So there are four questions that are in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. And question number one, is my number, whatever number I picked, generous? Because as Christians, we want to be like God, and God's generous. So 2 Corinthians 8, 1 and 2, which we've looked at in each of these weeks, says, and now, brothers, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. Remember, they were the poor ones. Out of the most severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. These were poor people, so they didn't have much, so generosity was relative, but they were generous. And over in chapter 9, verses 5 and 6, give a generous gift, not as one grudgingly given. Remember this, whoever sows sparingly also reaps sparingly, and whoever sows generously will also reap generously. So if your number is generous, whatever your number is, leave it alone. If you'd like to be more generous, increase the number. Question number two in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 is the question, am I able? Because the New Testament teaches that we should give on the basis of what we have, not what we don't have. It is what is called proportionate giving. So the more we have, the more we give. The less we have, the less we give. So back to chapter 8, verse 3. They gave as much as they were able, and even beyond their ability. And verse 12. For if the willingness is there, the gift is acceptable according to what one has, not according to what he does not have. So if I pick a number and I say, well, that's not very generous, I'd like to increase the number, but then it's obvious I don't have those kind of resources because God hasn't blessed me with those kind of resources, then I adjust the number down. So the question is, whatever your number is up to, is that within the range of your ability to give? Question number three is, how do I compare? For a helpful way to decide how much to give is to compare oneself with other committed Christians. And by the way, whenever we compare ourselves, we've got to decide who we're comparing to. So do we want to compare with those that are believers or not believers, those who are serious about their faith or those that aren't serious about their faith? Chapter 8, verse 8, I'm not commanding you, St. Paul says, but I want to test the sincerity of your love by comparing it with the earnestness of others. So he says, I'm not telling anybody anything that they've got to do. It's totally up to you. It's just helpful to make a comparison to other people who are sincere, committed, loving Christians. Question number four, the last of the four adjustment questions in these two chapters, is this my fair share? Now, remember, Paul's up north in Macedonia with poor Christians. They're collecting money. He's trying to convince the richer Christians in Corinth in the south to add their money, and they're sending Titus over to Jerusalem to help out these Christians who are in desperate straits over in Jerusalem. And he's saying, let's be fair about this. Everybody does their fair share. So in chapter 8, verses 13 to 15, he writes, our desire is not that others might be relieved while you are hard-pressed, but that there might be equality. At the same time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, their plenty will supply what you need. then there will be equality. As it is written, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little did not have too little. There's another way of asking this fairness question, and the way I would ask it of myself is, if everybody else did exactly what I did, what would the results of that be? If everybody were just like me, what would the effect then of my generosity be? Okay, that's pretty much it. That pretty much, I think, kind of answers the question. If someone wants to be a Christian giver, you pick any number, you adjust it up or down on the question of whether it's generous or not, how it fits with your ability to give, how it compares to other committed Christians, and whether you think that's a fair share. And then we've got the answer of what our giving ought to be to bless others. Now, there is a lot of other information that's in these chapters, and it can be helpful as well. So let's look at just a few more things. Among others is that Paul encouraged the Christians in Corinth to plan ahead, to think in advance about what they were going to do, because that's something that good givers do. Good giving is generally not the result of an emotional spur-of-the-moment decision, but is part of a plan. So back in chapter 8, verses 10 and 11, he writes, "And here is my advice about what is best for you in this matter. Last year, you were the first not only to give, but also to have the desire to do so. Now finish the work so that your eager willingness to do it may be matched by your completion of it according to your means." So he encouraged them to decide a year in advance what they should do to give to these starving Christians in Jerusalem. Or over in chapter 9, verse 2, he says, "For I know your eagerness to help, and I have been boasting about it to the Macedonians, telling them that since last year you in Achaia were ready to give, and your enthusiasm has stirred most of them to action." And in verse 5, "So I thought it necessary to urge the brothers to visit you in advance and finish the arrangements for the generous gift that you had promised." So it's simply saying, think ahead about this. Think ahead about generosity. We think ahead about taxes. We think ahead about vacation. We think ahead about retirement, that we should also think ahead about generosity. And that's especially good advice for me at the end of a calendar year, anticipating the new calendar that is beginning. The other piece of information that is helpful that is included in these two chapters is about deciding where to give. And the New Testament addresses that quite clearly. There is some good advice about how to decide where our giving should go. I need to make clear, again, something that was mentioned last week, but I'll reiterate it this week, and that is this is not primarily about giving to or through Wooddale Church. Now, obviously, I wholeheartedly believe in Wooddale Church and what we are doing and encourage support, but what we're talking about here is being a generous Christian, not being a generous Wooddaler. Totally different subject. The New Testament guidelines that are listed here in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 are for all Christians at all times, everywhere. And it starts out by making a decision where to be generous by the passion that we have, and that we should share a passion. So give money and time and other support where you have a passion for Jesus and where there is a need. Again, I'll ask you to follow along. In 2 Corinthians 8, this time verses 16 and 17, he says, referring to himself, Paul, "I thank God who put into the heart of Titus the same concern I have for you. For Titus not only welcomed our appeal, but he is coming to you with much enthusiasm and on his own initiative." So it touched his heart, Titus, that there were Christians in Jerusalem that didn't have enough to eat. These poor people are just flat out broke and desperate. And it was such a touching thing on his heartstrings that he decided he wanted to give. And then he's saying to the Christians in Macedonia and in Corinth, "Don't you want to do the same thing?" And they did. So they gave out of their passion. That's what their heart told them to do. Giving should always be about feeling, about emotion, about heart, about passion. And where we give ought to be where our heart is directed. And where the reception is trustworthy. We need to make sure that when we give, we're giving to a destination that is wise and correct in the use of the funds that are given. because you know, we all know, it's a sad thing to generously, sacrificially give and then find out that the gift that we have given has been wasted. So it's in verses 18 and 19 that Paul says, we are ascending along with him, the brother who is praised by all the churches for his service to the gospel. Oh, you got to follow along these pronouns here. He's saying Titus is going to take this money to these Christians who are poor in Jerusalem, but somebody else is going along with him. Someone who is praised by all the churches. What is more, he was chosen by the churches to accompany us as we carry the offering, which we administer in order to honor the Lord himself and to show our eagerness to help. So he's making sure that there are at least three hands, that there are at least three people, there are at least three sets of eyes that are watching to make sure that everything that is done is absolutely trustworthy. And that's the way I want to give. It's the way we all want to give, to make sure that that which we contribute is used in a way to honor the Lord himself. Paul's third description in terms of where to give is that it be connected to other Christians. That in this case, multiple churches and multiple Christians were involved. It wasn't someone who was operating unilaterally or secretly or privately. They were in this with other Christians together, convinced that together they could accomplish things that independently they couldn't. So it's in chapter 8, verse 23. He says, as for Titus, he is my partner and fellow worker among you. As for our brothers, they are representatives of the churches and an honor to Christ. So they pooled their resources as Christians and even as churches in order to help the Christians that were in Jerusalem. And the last piece that Paul puts in for his own contributions is accountability. You know why? Because whatever money is involved, there is always a risk of abuse. There is always a risk that people will manipulate, they will steal. Even sometimes the best of people just don't resist temptation. So he says in 2 Corinthians 8, 20 and 21, we want to avoid any criticism of the way we administer this liberal gift. For we are taking pains to do what is right, not only in the eyes of the Lord, but also in the eyes of men. He's going to great lengths to make sure that there's no lack of accountability. We would say today, in modern terms, that we're talking here about auditing of books, external audits, financial statements, all of those things. That when we contribute that which we are giving in the name of Jesus Christ, we should make sure that there is accountability in terms of how those monies are used. And the last piece of it is just simple logic, and that is to follow through. That he wanted to make sure that those Corinthian Christians heard all of this, that they were generous because they wanted to be like God, that they had fun doing it, that they were cheerful givers, they delighted the heart of God, that they thought through in advance what they were going to do, that they made a plan, that they were wise in their generosity, but that they do it. And it's not good enough to just think about everything, that they follow through. So in 2 Corinthians 9, verse 7, he says, each one should give what he has decided in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. In other words, do it. Decide in your heart, but then follow through. Be that kind of a generous person. Now, I want to tell you a story tonight that I think brings it all together for what is taught in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. It is the story of Terry Iverson. And I need to explain to you that Terry is a Wooddaler who was scheduled to give her faith story here tonight, but because of her illness and physical disability, was unable to come. So I will tell her story as best I can. Terry wrote a letter to me in January of this year, saying that she had planned what she was going to give as a Christian in the year 2004. But because she had lost her job and because of her serious illness, she simply did not have the money. And what should she do? So the response was obvious, and that is, Terry, you don't need to give anything. Don't worry about it. God's special blessings upon you. On August 6th of this year, she wrote another letter to me. Enclosed in this letter were checks for every one of the weeks that she had missed this year. The amounts of the checks were $30, $40, $10, and $7.50. And here's what she wrote. "It has always been a joy for me to give to God. So yes, it was a disappointment to me to stop giving. Also, going through the financial and physical demands has become overwhelming. I'm writing to tell you that the Lord has blessed me with an award from the state, and now I am receiving a Social Security disability check. It is not a lot, but it is much more than I have had in a long time. Enclosed, I have written out checks for May, June, and July of 2004. Now, I do not want you to think it is great to be disabled, nor do I feel sorry for myself, as I know God has plans for me, and I am blessed to know in my heart that I am a Christian and I belong to a wonderful church family. At this point, I can give $30 to $40 a month, joyfully, joyfully. I wish it were more, but I continue to honor him and serve him when and where I can, on the email prayer team and as a greeter. I cannot always get to church every weekend and do not feel good about that, but I always pray and read my Bible every day. Thank you for listening and being so understanding and kind. I realize giving financially to God is not something demanded. It is given from the heart, no matter what the size. God bless all of you." And if she were here tonight, Terry would say, "God bless all of you." Terry Iverson. Now I'll tell you, I'm impressed, and she touches my heart. But she's got her New Testament Christianity absolutely right. Absolutely right. So I want to read to you again the opening five verses of 2 Corinthians chapter 8. But I'm going to take out Paul's reference to the Macedonians, and I am going to insert in that place the name of a Wooddaler, Terry Iverson. "And now we want you to know about the grace that God has given Terry Iverson. Out of the most severe trial, her overflowing joy and her extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that she gave as much as she was able, and even beyond her ability. Entirely on her own, she urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in this service to the saints. And she did not do as we expected, but she gave herself first to the Lord, and then to us, in keeping with God's will." Father, touch our hearts that we may be first given to you, first given to Jesus Christ, and then out of all of the generosity that we have received and our unwavering commitment to your Son, may we in turn be like Terry. May we in turn be like Jesus. Amen.